Okay, welcome to a warm Friday afternoon in which I may have bitten off more than I can chew. We'll find out. So I'm going to try to tell you about the connection between the Brouwer group and elliptic torsors. And I promised you examples, and I can do the examples, so that's good. I'm not sure if I can really get through the general theory. So what's the Picard group of an algebraic variety? The Picard group is describing line bundles. And there's an interesting way of looking at it in complex geometry. So the line bundles can be thought of as elements of H1 of X with coefficients in the nowhere vanishing functions, right? And so we could talk about, in complex geometry, complex analytic geometry, we could talk about analytic line bundles or algebraic line bundles. And there's this basic Gaga principle of Serre, which tells you that the algebraic line bundles, when regarded as analytic line bundles, behave in basically the same way. And in complex geometry, there's this nice exponential exact sequence in which you take a function, exponentiate to get a nowhere vanishing function, and then the kernel is 2 pi I z. Well, whether you put the 2 pi I there depends on how you define the exponential. And I should say, in algebraic geometry, there's a sort of similar thing, the Kummer sequence, which serves many of the same purposes, in which you look at the mth power map on non-vanishing functions. And people, because these are non-vanishing functions, people tend to put ones instead of zeros in their exact sequences sometimes. So the point of the story in complex geometry is that if I take what is something in H1 of this? That means, I can think of this in Czech cohomology, for example, and so that means that I'm taking an open cover and I'm taking an invertible function on each element of the cover, and it's supposed to satisfy a cocycle condition. And if that element comes from something in H1 of O, you end up with trivial bundles. So the Picard group gets identified with H1 X O X star mod H1 X O X in this complex geometry setting. And I think I just said that wrong. Yeah, I'm very sorry. I said that wrong. That's not what I want to say. The Picard group is this guy. So the Picard group receives a map from H1XOX mod H1X2πiz. And H1OX is some vector space whose dimension is it's called the Hodge number H10 of the complex variety, and what we're doing here is taking a complex space of that dimension modulo an integer lattice of the same dimension, and that produces a torus. So this guy is a torus, and then we have the Picard group, and then in the long exact sequence of this exponential sequence, the next map goes to H2 of X with coefficients in 2 pi I z. This is the first Chern class map, an interpretation of the first Chern class map. And so what this sequence says is that the bundles with trivial first Chern class can be identified with this torus. It's sometimes called pick zero. It's the bundles which are trivial in cohomology. So there are various versions of the Brouwer group story. But one of the versions is to look at H2 of x with coefficients in non-vanishing functions. And there's a natural classifying map just for in complex geometry that comes from the connecting homomorphism in the sequence. And this guy, H2 of x with coefficients in the non-zero functions, is often called the cohomological Brouwer group. And it has a natural map to H3x 2 pi I z. So there are other definitions of Brouwer group. The Brouwer group is the set of Azumaya algebras modulo equivalence. How many people have heard of the Brouwer group? How many people have heard of Azumaya algebra? Okay. So maybe I won't spend a lot of time on this interpretation, but these are algebras with the property that they're locally isomorphic to matrix algebras. So sheaves of algebras, locally isomorphic to n by n matrix algebras. And because you can do this over non-algebraically closed fields and look at the base change, this turns out to contain the entire theory of classical theory of central simple algebras over a field, a non-algebraically closed field, over K. What you do is sort of go to an extension, K prime over K, and ask that after you base change to an extension, it's isomorphic to a matrix algebra. And that's one of the equivalent definitions of central simple algebras over K. So anyway, this construction at an algebraic level is supposed to be quite reminiscent of the construction of central simple algebras over K, and it's also related to classification of projective bundles, which I think I'm not going to try to explain either, of Pn bundles over a scheme X. Okay, so there's this notion of a Brouwer group of an algebraic variety. And what Dolgachev and Gross do in a quite technical fashion, which is a little hard to extract information from, is relate this Brouwer group to elliptic torsors. And the basic way that they do it is based on an exact sequence given an elliptic vibration. So, so I should have mentioned that the interesting part of the Brouwer group is torsion. And so you end up, under good situations, you end up actually with an isomorphism between that cohomological Brouwer group and the torsion in the integral H3. So having torsion elements in cohomology groups is a kind of interesting thing, and finding examples of those is also a kind of interesting thing. So Dolgachev and Gross are studying a good model of a genus 1 vibration. So let me remind you what the basic setup is. I the good model is going to be some model x over s, like this. And the property that I would like the good model to have is that f should be flat and projective, and x and s should be regular, also known as non-singular. Regular integral, which is essentially non-singular for our purposes. And we want the generic fiber of this guy to be a model of a torsor for some given E, which is an elliptic curve, something with a section, over the function field of S. So, as I explained a couple weeks ago, what we mean by this is that there is an action of the elliptic curve on the genus 1 curve. This is all working over the generic point of x over x eta. There's an action of this elliptic curve on the torsor, which is a free action. And the elliptic curve has a fixed point, which corresponds to, if you use this point, you end up with the identity map on x eta. But the genus 1 curve over the generic point of S is not required to itself have a point, and that's the difference between having it be an elliptic curve and just a torsor for the elliptic curve. So it's got an action by the elliptic curve. And the basic problem is to find ways to classify, given E, find ways of classifying all such genus 1 fibrations. So the existence of a good model is something I'm going to be using as an assumption today. We've been working towards that in the other lectures, showing something about blowing up and starting to get flat projective models of genus 1 vibrations. But in a way, the key to having examples with a non-trivial torsor structure or a non-trivial Brouwer group is to have a difference in singularity between XS and the corresponding family with a section. So I'm going to call the family with a section Y over S. That one has a section, so the generic fiber of Y is this guy I've just been calling E. And the typical way to get interesting examples will be that X is a good model, but Y has no good model. Unless S is blown up. And I'll try to explain in examples what's going on with that. So the basic tool that these guys introduce is an exact sequence, which is based on a fact that Ri. Okay, so so I introduced this cohomological Brouwer group a minute ago in the complex analytic context, and let me just recast the definition in some way that works completely in algebraic geometry. So we look at non-zero functions, which can be thought of as a sheaf called GM, the group of multiplicative units, and that's a sort of algebraic way of describing the same basic structure. And the Picard group will end up being, in this interpretation, H1 of X with coefficients in those units. And then there's a sort of key lemma that these guys prove, which is that for a good model, for a good model, Ri F lower star Gm is equal to 0 for all I bigger than 1.
So the F is the projection map from X to S. So thanks to such a vanishing statement, they get a long exact sequence relating Picard and Brouwer groups of the base and the fiber, as well as some other terms involving maybe R1 F lower star Gm. So the this long exact sequence is actually derived pretty directly from the Lorentz spectral sequence for that morphism and this sheaf Gm using this fact about the vanishing of everything other than Ri. And it turns out that all the information about the spectral sequence, if you only have R1 F lower star, all the information about the spectral sequence collapses into this particular long exact sequence. And it looks like this. You take Picard group of S, you can pull back line bundles on S to get line bundles on X. Then the next term is H0 of S, R1 pi lower star, F lower star, excuse me, Gm. Now we go into this cohomological Brouwer group of S, which was like the H2 term, the cohomological Brouwer group of X. We have another sort of middle term in here. And we can keep going. H3, S, Gm, and so on, as long as you need to go. So here is the main geometric claim about these sequences. And the main geometric claim says that if you figure out, so here's something important to think about for these genus 1 fibrations. So the genus 1 fibration doesn't have a section, but there are plenty of divisors in X which map surjectively onto the base. And you can ask for any such divisor in X, what's the intersection number with the general fiber? So the general fiber is some elliptic curve that's a curve on this surface, and there's an intersection number with the divisor, and there's a minimum such positive intersection number. Maybe the maybe delta eta is the minimum degree of divisor, and delta S is the minimum degree of a divisor with the property that which is isomorphic to S under projection. So geometrically, there are a few things that can happen. You might have, not isomorphic, but finite, which is mapped to S is finite and flat, which is finite and flat. So typically, since we've got to have multiple points in the fiber for each point in S, we're going to have something like a finite cover of S. But it could be that at singular fibers, we had to include something of higher dimension, right? So the basic, one of the basic consequences of flatness is that the fibers should be equidimensional. And the fibers here will be dimension 0 of this divisor over S. So it might be that if you looked for the minimum degree of divisor, you could find a small degree with a property that not every inverse image of a point in S was dimension 0. And then you might find a slightly larger degree with the property that it actually was a finite cover of S, which gave you the thing. And
This is obviously related to the question of what is our torsor structure. We are going to have, we don't have a point on x eta, but we have a multivalued point. And I guess having a multivalued point really means if you make a base change from, say, eta to the generic point at d, right? So you're going to have a base change from eta bar, or eta tilde, maybe it's not a bar, which is the generic point of d, then the thing will be trivial as a torsor, because once you've made that base change, you actually have a degree one point, which defined over this guy d. And so under some circumstances, for some uses, you might want that to have actually been a flat base change. In other cases, you don't care. So there are these two possible notions of minimal degree. So one of the key lemmas is that so here's the geometric claim, the kernel of the map from HI SGN to HI XGN is killed by this order delta sub s. So if I can find the minimum degree, well, it'd be killed by any degree, right? If I can find any divisor which is flat over the base, then the order of that divisor, the number of points it times it meets the fiber, kills this term in, it kills the corresponding term in any of these guys. And in particular, if you are trying to compare, you know, Brouwer group, cohomological Brouwer group of total space to base, knowing what order of torsion you need to be studying is useful for kind of extracting the information. So I admit that what I just said sounds a bit vague. I have a somewhat shaky understanding of how all of these things fit together. They extensively quote the papers Grotendieck originally wrote about these Brouwer group things, which have proofs that are difficult to digest. And well, anyway, the whole point of this series of lectures is to try to get to a place where we could understand better and more concretely what's going on with this structure. So I want to mention a couple of examples, illustrative examples, which kind of show what the phenomenon is that's going on. The point that I want to make is that if I study the elliptic vibration with section, this may have a model over S. This may have no model over S, which is non-singular. But after blowing S up, it may have a non-singular model. So what we did last time was we discussed the first step in resolving Weierstrass model. So the first step in resolving Weierstrass model is to resolve all the Kodaira types. And there's a prescription for how to blow up the singular loci, which are occurring, S, I keep calling it S, it's in the examples that we're interested in, it's a surface. Ultimately, one would like to do this for S being of arbitrary dimension. And so on the base of the elliptic vibration, I've got some Kodaira divisors.
delta j, and over any one of those Cotterer divisors, I have a curve, excuse me, I have a codimension 2 locus, cj, singular locus in the fiber. And what we started to discuss, or outlined at least last time, was how to blow up those codimension 2 loci in X in order to at least generically resolve the singularities. In the case of dimension S equals 2, there's an algorithm of Miranda which goes a little further. So if dimension S is equal to 2, Miranda's idea is to produce a model. Miranda's going to produce a model by sufficient blowing up of S, which will be flat over the base. So that's good. That's something that has sort of come up in these discussions. Miranda's idea is to get a model flat over the base. He's going to impose a bunch of conditions, flat over S. We'll impose, first of all, we want the discriminant to have normal crossings, simple normal crossings. So by one of Hironaka's resolution theorems, blowing up the base sufficiently much will produce a simple normal crossings divisor. It's not the generic thing. We'll see in examples in a few minutes that it's something we don't really want to do in most cases, but anyway, this is an algorithm. And once you have simple normal crossings, you also want to ensure that the J function, which is a priori a rational map from S to P1, we want to ensure that this is well-defined. Sorry, maybe I got the order wrong. Maybe first I have to blow up to make this well-defined, and then I have to blow up to ensure simple normal crossings. Anyway, both of these are achieved by blowing up on the base. And so that now we make a list of possible collisions. So what does that mean? Well, the components of the discriminant are each labeled by a Cotterer type. And actually, each Cotterer type has some information about a J invariant as well. So already ensuring that the J invariant is well-defined has restricted the possible collisions. So we can have collisions J equals zero collisions. And the J equals zero Cotterer types involve, I don't consider I0 because I'm insisting on singularity. So the J equals zero collisions include types 2, 4, I0 star sometimes, 4 star, and 2 star. And the capital J equals 1 collisions. In other normalizations, sometimes that's called J equals 1728, include collisions among types 3, I0 star, and 3 star. And then there are J equals infinity collisions, which include collisions among I sub m and I sub n star. And you know, I need to be prepared to list things more than once if I'm thinking of collisions, because I might have collisions between things of the same type. So Miranda checks that by blowing up certain collisions, you remove that kind of collision and end up with some other kinds of collisions. I'll explain in a minute why he wants to do that, but I wanted to make a list, if I can find it again, of the allowed collisions. And
Grimm model. Actually, here we go.
So the possible collisions that are allowed for Miranda are IM1 plus IM2. And this one has a certain caveat, so we have to talk about it in a minute. And then IM1 plus IM2 star. So in particular, we're not going to allow IN star to collide with another IN star. Those are the only J equal infinity collisions. We'll allow 2 and 4. We'll allow 2 and 1, 0 star. We'll allow 2 and 4 star. And we'll allow 4 and 1, 0 star. So I've disallowed, for example, 2 and 2 star, 4 and 4 star. What else? 4 and 2 star. So those are the J equals 0 collisions, and then the only J equal 1 collision that's allowed is 3 plus I 0 star. So the claim is that I can, if I see other kinds of collisions, I blow them up, and when I blow them up, I create simpler types of collisions than I already have, and in the end, for example, there are no collisions involving a 2-star or a 3-star in this picture, only a very relatively minor list of collisions. So what's the advantage for Miranda in doing this? Well, the advantage is that he's got two curves. So again, dimension 2, he's doing things explicitly in dimension 2. So he's got two curves in the base, both components of the discriminant locus, and he has a particular kind of Kodaira fiber happening over those curves. So, for example, you might have IM1 and IM2. And I just remind you from last time what happens for IM1 and IM2. Along the IM1 locus, I end up with an AM minus 1 singularity. And so when I resolve that, I end up with a bunch of components. So this is my picture over delta 1. And for example, over a point in delta 1, I'm going to have rational curves like this, which are forming the resolution of this AM minus 1. And then over here, delta 2, I've got a different set of components. I've got, this is AM1 minus 1, and this is AM2 minus 2, minus 1, a different set of components. And what I have to deal with is what's happening here. And typically, if you had an AM minus 1 locus along here and an AM minus 2 locus, AM1 minus 1, and an AM2 minus 1 locus along those things, then you get a more complicated singularity at the intersection. In fact, at the intersection, you're roughly going to have something on the form y squared equals x cubed plus, excuse me, x squared plus, I'm ignoring the x cubed term, a big power of one of them times a big power of the other one, right? Those two variables come in, and so I have to have a way of resolving the singularities that are occurring at the collision. Well, there's one really nice thing that you could do to help resolve these singularities, and that is that the singularities you have after doing the first step of just blowing up along the singular loci to resolve the Kodaira singularities, you end up with singularities which are terminal in the technical sense of threefold singularities. We won't define that today. And they're terminal, and they can be resolved by blowing up additional V-divisors, which are not Cartier, on whatever X I have at that moment. Maybe I'll call it X bar because it's not fully blown up yet. Sorry, that's a Y. I'll call it Y bar because it's not fully blown up yet. So
a typical picture of that is that I had I had something like a singularity that looks like xy equals zt, and it's sort of coming at as an intersection. It was created by blow-ups of this kind, and now I might be able to take an x equals z equals 0 or x equals t equals 0 type v-divisor and blow that up and resolve the singularity. So Miranda shows that you can do this for an IM1 plus IM2 collision, so that's possible if M1 is at least 2 or M2 is at least 2. And the problem if M1 and M2 are both 1 is that you've got a single curve wrapping around like this coming along the component of the discriminant. And so there's no way near the intersection point to single out one of the divisors to blow up. In every other case, there's a divisor you can single out to blow up, and that divisor helps resolve the singularities that you find. Miranda does a computation in the paper which shows that this is what's happening. But if you have only a single divisor, if M1 is equal to 1, you can't use that side. Of course, you could use the other side unless also M2 is equal to 1. So these Miranda collisions, when you get to the Miranda collisions, you get a flat family which is non-singular, with the caveat being that here M1 is greater than or equal to 2 or M2 is greater than or equal to 2. And if you happen to have a collision which is an I1 plus I1 collision, then you just blow it up one more time. And blowing it up one more time has the effect of creating a new I2 locus, which now meets each of the I1s, and because of that, those collisions are now I1 plus I2, you can actually resolve the singularity. And he goes through the analysis for each of these collisions. It's probably a little bit overkill. One could probably do a direct analysis for more collisions than he did, but he wanted to show as efficiently as possible the existence of a flat model over an appropriate blow-up. And he was able to do it by just looking at this particular set of collisions. Okay, so what is this going to have to do with the structure of these interesting examples of torsors? So the basic phenomenon, which exists already in examples of the Dolgachev-Gross paper and which was rediscovered first by a physicist named Daniel Park, and then Daniel and I together worked out kind of the mathematics behind it. The basic phenomenon is that the discriminant locus of y over s will have, when there is an interesting torsor for y over s, the discriminant locus for y over s will have nodes. And typically these nodes are actually irreducible nodes. And what's happening at a generic point of the discriminant locus is that we have Kadary type I1. And so we're precisely in this situation that Miranda was concerned with, where if you saw an I1, I1 collision, then really if you wanted to be able to fully resolve the total space, you had to blow up those collision points. So I end up with some version of this guy with the collision points blown up into rational curves. Those rational curves turn out to be I2 loci in the Kadira notation, and then I still have all my I1, my irreducible I1 locus, and
the irreducible I1 locus. So now I get a flat family over the blow-up where I've blown up the purple points, the nodes of the discriminant locus. Now, we'll see in a moment, at least in one particular example, how that gets related to the existence of this twist. But one of the, so the lemma that I erased over here would have predicted that because I've got singularities of this particular type, I would have potentially torsion elements potentially torsion elements in my Brouwer-Severi or in my group of torsors, which were killed by delta S. And then those torsion elements go away if I blow up the space. So the total space here is singular, but that singular total space turns out to have an interesting H3. So this is another version of the same story, that you can calculate the H3 of the singular space as having these non-trivial torsion elements, which again go away when you blow up the points in the base. So I know I'm not explaining that part of it very well, and I will try to do a better job in a subsequent lecture. Let me spend the end of this one going through a very explicit example, which is a very pretty one. And the starting point for this example is starting point of this example is just to look at cubics, non-singular cubics, in P2. So I remind you that the way that we describe Weierstrass, elliptic curves that have a point in Weierstrass form is to use a particular kind of cubic, but that particular kind of cubic is adapted to the fact that I've got a section of this thing and something in Weierstrass form. And if I take a much more general cubic, a Fermat or whatever you like, in three homogeneous variables, then typically in a family, there is no section. So, in fact, I'll let S be a base point free net, I have to explain that word, of cubics in P2. And I'll work over an algebraically closed field of characteristic zero. So net is a word like pencil. It simply means that it's a vector space of dimension two, of dimension three. And typically, this is actually the projectivization of the vector space. So I'm thinking of my two-parameter family of cubics as being given by linear combinations of three particular cubics. So I might take the Fermat and two others. I want to make sure that there are no common base points, but that's pretty easy. If I take two cubics, distinct cubics, they will meet in exactly 9 points. And so finding a third one which doesn't contain any of those 9 points is easy. So I can describe a two-parameter family of cubics in this way, and then look at an incidence relation, x inside of P2 cross S, right, which is the set of points in P2 and cubics C, such that the point is contained in the cubic. So this is dimension 2 plus 2 is 4. This is a single relation among these that's just a linear relation on the coefficients of the cubic, right? Take the coefficients of the cubic, take the point, and you get one linear relation. And so this defines an elliptic threefold over S. So genus one vibration over S. And it has no section, as I was pointing out, that when we take a family of cubics like this, we don't, unless we've done something like put it in Dwyer stress form to begin with, we don't expect a section for the guy. But there is a three section. So there are there's a divisor D sitting inside of X, which maps S to S 3:1, and the divisor D, the three section, is simply given by a fixed line in P2. The fixed line in P2 will meet the cubics in my net in 3 points each, and so I'll get these 3 points of intersection with each of the cubics, and that is something which will project down to the set of cubics. So I get 3 points for each one, and this degree that I talked about before, delta S, turns out to be 3. That turns out to be the minimal. You have to argue a little bit about why there couldn't be a 2 section in this situation, but geometrically it's pretty evident that that there couldn't be a 2 section. And one shows that the Tate-Shafravitch group, which is the torsors that have a local section, the Tate-Shafravitch group of the corresponding Jacobian vibration is actually isomorphic to Z mod delta S Z, in this case Z mod 3 Z, and that we have generated by X a non-trivial element of the vibration. So to relate it to this geometry of the Miranda model, let me tell you the structure of the Jacobian of this vibration. So the Jacobian of X over S is some, well, I'm calling it J over S, and there's some discriminant locus contained in this net for the Jacobian, and it's classically known, which means like in the 19th century, that delta is a curve in P2 of degree 12 with 24 cusps and 21 nodes. If you write down a general Weierstrass model over P2, so my S here is P2, right? If I write down a general Weierstrass model over P2, then it has a whole bunch of cusps. It necessarily has a whole bunch of cusps because of the equation of delta. So delta is the set of zeros of 4f cubed plus 27g squared. So anytime you have, and f and g are polynomials, in this case perhaps of degrees 4 and 6 on P2. So if you have, so those are homogeneous polynomials of degree 4 or 6, they have to meet someplace. And if f and g have a common zero, then you get a cusp singularity for the discriminant. But these have the unusual property that they have many fewer cusps. Actually, we could count the number of cusps. It's not fewer cusps. F is degree 4 and g is degree 6, so there should have been 24 cusps anyway. But these have the unusual property that in addition to the 24 cusps, they have 21 nodes. And those 21 nodes, by Miranda's analysis, prevent... I should have mentioned that Miranda's analysis goes the other way as well. If you have an I1 plus I1 collision, there is no way to blow it up. If you were able to blow... There is no way to blow it up unless the corresponding double point of the discriminant is the result of intersecting two distinct components of the discriminant. So if you have two distinct components of the discriminant, you'll be able to use that to blow it up. But if the components of the discriminant are not distinct, you won't be able to do that. And here we actually get an irreducible curve with these 21 nodes, so none of them will be resolvable. So you start to go through the Miranda procedure, and if you try to avoid blowing up S, okay, so that violates the normal crossing condition. We have to worry a little bit about what happened at those nodes, but that actually turns out not to be a problem. The point is that, at the cusps, rather, the point is that away from the cusps, you have this phenomenon of these conifold-like singularities, singularities with quadratic equations, which have no small resolution unless you were to blow up the base at the 21 points. So that is what is responsible for the existence of the twisted section, according to the calculation that Dolgachev and Gross make, and it sort of shows up in the classical geometry as well. So I will stop there. Next week I will not give a lecture in this series, but I will resume the following week, March 3rd or whatever it is, 4th. Any questions?
So what did that computation of the Chafarevich group actually tell us?
Since we have something there that has no section, we know that we're in, I mean, that there is some element in the Tate-Chafarevich group associated to it, and the fact that there was this three section is what enables one to show that the Tate-Chafarevich group of the Jacobian had a three torsion element, or any element in it was going to be three torsion. By the way, it's interesting to ask, what about the inverse of the Z3 element, right? And but it turns out that that geometrically you end up with the same vibration but with the opposite torsor action. So you just sort of reverse the torsor action but with the same vibration and get the other element of the Tate-Chafarevich group. The slightly more mysterious part is, what is it about the Jacobian vibration that causes there to possibly be this guy? And, you know, some of the results that Dolgachev and Gross prove are that if you're able to find, over the same base, if you're able to find a model with a non-singular total space, then there couldn't have been any torsor of the thing whatsoever. And this kind of explains what's going on there because, yes, in fact, we know from Miranda's analysis that because there are those nodes, we won't be able to find a non-singular model for the Jacobian. We'll be stuck with these terminal singularities that have no resolution, and that's exactly what you're expecting from the point of view of these slightly more general results of Dolgachev and Gross. So every time I go through their paper at the beginning, I feel like I'm going to really understand it this time, and then by the end, I'm less enthusiastic. So hopefully by the end of this process, we will all better understand what's going on with these things. Yes?
What questions about strings is this the answer to?
Okay, so the question about these torsors is a question about the discrete symmetries. Of F theory compactified on, it's really F theory compactified on the Jacobian. I think of it as being F theory compactified on S with the data of the Jacobian.
Okay.
And the reason this corresponds to discrete symmetries in the F-theory compactification is that if you have discrete symmetries in the F-theory compactification and you compactify on one additional circle, those discrete symmetries cause you to have different possible vacuum states after compactifying on the circle, corresponding to the choice that's made of which discrete symmetry you use as a so-called Wilson line around the circle. So what we're seeing here geometrically is a collection of elliptically fibered threefolds, let's say, just to fix dimension, with the same Jacobian fibration. The F-theory is only sensitive to the Jacobian fibration, whereas the M-theory is supposed to give you an M-theory model for every non-singular guy. So seeing a collection of non-singular guys tells you that there had to have been discrete symmetry in F-theory. We don't know how to calculate those directly, but we're finding them by finding the effect that they have one dimension down. So having a complete, having a better dictionary of how to read off what possible torsors there are would give you a systematic way of saying what the discrete symmetries in F-theory compactification are. Yes?
Would it be possible for every cubic in that net to be singular?
Every cubic in the net to be singular. If you have a base point free linear system, the generic, in characteristic zero, the generic element is non-singular away from the, if you have a linear system, the generic element is non-singular away from the base locus. This one's even better because there's no base locus, so the generic element has to be non-singular. You should try it, right? You could take something like, you know, a singular one with a singular point and another one with a singular point, and then you start to take linear combinations. Well, the singular point over here, it works for one combination, and the singular point over here works for the other, but there's no sort of interpolating singular point. That's roughly what's happening. More questions? Marco, this is number four, or number three. Number three in a series, so, you know.
I know.
You could listen to the others. The audio is online.
Okay. The paper, or the investigation by Daniel Park, was that written up at some point?
Park and I wrote, I mean, Park had some preliminary indications of this in a paper he had written by himself earlier, but the main thing is this paper that Park and I wrote in 2012, maybe 2013.
Would the Brouwer groups be computable if we didn't start with elliptic vibrations? Can we do the algebraic computation on the Brouwer group side for general n without having all the necessary geometrics just because algebra doesn't give us the dimension?
So the computation of Brouwer groups is another sort of challenging thing. I don't know that it's been carried out in that many examples. It's this interesting tool, and but you know, when it comes down to in any of its formulations, either how do you get your hands on the torsion in topology, or how do you get your hands on these Azimuth algebras, and how do you know you have all of them, right? There don't seem to be good constructive tools for this thing, which is too bad. Maybe we can make some.
So how would we write down the Weierstrass model for that vibration going there?
Okay, so this is a tricky thing. If you have a genus one curve, how do you write its Weierstrass vibration? And here I have a situation where as I mentioned, I kind of know a three section. So I have these triples of points. And so I'd like to kind of use one of those as a guide to building the Picard group of the thing. What I can tell you is that for for cases with a two section, a three section, and a four section, there are classical methods in the literature
which really date back to the 19th century, for starting with a family and writing down the Weierstrass family. Having said that, the formulas are not fun to deal with, but there are formulas. And there is an argument about why those formulas are the right thing to do. Once you get beyond degree four, you don't have an expression for the elliptic curve directly as a complete intersection in the projective space, and that makes it harder to describe the ideal, and maybe apparently harder to describe the Jacobian. There are some formulas for the Jacobians of degree five elliptic curves, which work in this kind of context. I don't think there are formulas that have been written down beyond that. The following is not a derivation of the formula, but is an explanation of why there could be a formula, and actually a nice way to remember what the formula is in the case of degree two. So this was degree three, but if I have degree two, what that means is I'm studying a family of elliptic curves where I'm choosing 4 points, and I'm taking a double cover of P1 branched in 4 points, instead of, in the usual Weierstrass method, choosing one of those points and fixing it and being able to take the double cover branched in 3. So having 4 points means that I'm looking at a homogeneous polynomial of degree 4 in 2 variables, and the zeros of that homogeneous polynomial of degree 4 tell me where to take the double cover to describe the genus 1 curve. And so here's the claim. The Jacobian of this is a Weierstrass guy, maybe I should use a different letter, for a cubic polynomial. I'm going to use the same variables here, except maybe I'm going to call this one, F and G we use in Weierstrass language all the time, so I'm going to call these phi and psi. For a cubic polynomial psi, and the cubic polynomial happens to be the following one. If you want to solve a homogeneous quartic, then you have to deal with, in general, a field extension whose Galois group is the symmetric group S4. The symmetric group S4 has this beautiful homomorphism to the symmetric group S3, whose kernel is Z2 squared. And this homomorphism is actually the basis for the Cardano-type formulas from the 16th century that actually solved this guy. And what you're supposed to do is you take your phi 4, and the first thing you do is you generate the so-called resolvent cubic of the phi 4. And that resolvent cubic actually provides the Weierstrass form for the degree 2 curve. So this way of presenting it does not prove that that's true. But it is, it's a sort of easy way to remember that it's true. And there are formulas for resolving cubics in terms of the coefficients of the quartic. And if you don't know the formula, you can work it out. It's a fun Galois theory exercise. I don't have an explanation like that over here in the degree 3 case. In the degree 3 case, there's this massive formula. People worked on it for a while in the early 2000s, giving versions that work independent of characteristic, for example, so that you can.
But if you were to take like the base change over the section, right?
Right.
So that you kind of then you get a section and on a section after that.
Well, so I have this curve, and then I have this curve. This one has a section. This one doesn't have a section. So I need. So you're right. After some base change, I should be able to write down the section of the degree 2 guy. I mean, that looks a little different from the Galois theory perspective, right? That looks like adjoining one root of the quartic should be the base change, which works. But in fact, you're supposed to use the resolvent cubic instead. So it's a little funny. Did I do this for you guys last spring? Did we solve the quartic?
think I was probably following BC's notes too closely. If I had been teaching it myself, I would have solved the quarter for you. But I don't think I did.
I think we did the cubic, though.
We did the cubic? Okay. All right.